Right there.
Are you ready?
Dead zone for a quarter mile around the house.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources for February 25th, 2013. And I just want to make an announcement that we are going to do our first order of business. We're going to do a work session and a quick public hearing. It'll be very quick, and then we can move into the Columbia River presentation and not have to rush you all. So I just wanted to make that announcement first. Now that we have our final committee member, we'll go ahead and open up a work session on Senate Bill 474. And by the way, we have our a guest here, guest staff. Beth Riley is ill, and so we have our former committee staff, Beth Petrino. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I know you're on the other side, but my foot moved over here, so that's why. So with that, Beth, do you want to tell us anything about Senate Bill, remind us about Senate Bill 474?
Senate Bill 474 would add raccoons to the list of potentially habituated wildlife. There is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal.
Okay, excellent. So I did open a work session, didn't I?
You did.
We are in a work session, and I will take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 474 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 474, otherwise known as the Rocky Raccoon Bill, to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Bates.
I have three skunks living under the house that Barker and I are living in right now. Could we make a little amendment here about skunks? You know?
I would need to talk to ODF&W to find out if they're in the same family.
No, not really. I sometimes do have to say, though, that I think when I went through my last election, to come up here and have the opportunity to vote on this bill has made me really feel needed and necessary to be here. So thank you for this opportunity.
I think you need to thank our vice chair, Senator Olson.
Senator Olson, this is your bill, huh?
The raccoons were in last time and were taken out. Now they're back.
Okay.
Senator Hansel.
I understand it was the colleague whose place I took that kept the raccoons out of the bill. So I want you to know I'm fully in favor of putting the raccoons back in the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Any other discussion? We are doing, this is very important people's business. If you know, raccoons actually can be quite aggressive. And I had a little run-in with a raccoon when I was gardening not too long ago.
That's why her foot's in a cast.
Yes. And I let him or her, I'm not sure what sex it was, have full run of my garden because I was not going to mess with it. Anyway, is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Hansel?
Aye.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Chair
Dinkfelder? Aye. The motion passes. And Senator Olson, would you like to carry the Rocky Raccoon Bill?
Thank you very much. I would appreciate that.
With that, we will close the work session.
Hang out for a visual.
That's right.
Okay, we will go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 571. Beth, take it away.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 571 would add the State Marine Board Director or a designated representative to the Invasive Species Council. There is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact.
Okay, and do we have a list?
Do you guys give it to you?
Oh, yes, we did. I do have it. Okay. Thank you, Beth. So we have three people that would like to testify on this.
Okay.
Glenn Dolphin from the Marine Board. Is it Dolphin or Dolphin?
It's Dolphin.
That's really good.
Kind of fishy, isn't it?
Yeah. And we have Dan Hilburn and Tom Wolf. So why don't you all come up together? So Glenn is with the Marine, Don Dolphin is with the Marine Board.
Yes.
And we'll hand it over to you. And please remember to state your name for the record.
Hello, Senator Dinkfelder and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Glenn Dolphin, the Aquatic Invasive Species Program Coordinator for the Oregon State Marine Board. Since 2001, the Marine Board has been working to educate boaters about the growing threat of invasive species to the state. Starting in 2009, the Oregon legislature created the Aquatic Invasive Species Prevention Program. They assigned authority to manage and implement that program to the Oregon Marine Board and the Department of Fish and Wildlife. For the past 8 years, the Marine Board has been a member of the Invasive Species Council, and we have been serving in an appointed member position. Due to term limits for appointed members, the Marine Board is no longer eligible to serve as a voting council member. The Invasive Species Council is a very important advisory organization for the Marine Board and the Aquatic Invasive Species Program, and the Marine Board would welcome the opportunity to have a permanent seat on the council. We therefore support Senate Bill 571. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Why don't we go ahead and have everybody testify, and then we'll see if there's any questions.
Good afternoon. My name is Dan Hilburn. I'm the current chair of the Oregon Invasive Species Council. The council voted to support this bill and fully supports having the Marine Board as a permanent member. The council has enjoyed the input from the Marine Board the last 8 years that they've had a member as an appointed member. Aquatic invasive species have become more important in the last decade or so since the council was formed. So it makes sense to add the Marine Board to the group of agencies and non-agency people that coordinate invasive species programs in the state. So we would urge you to add the Marine Board as a permanent member to the Invasive Species Council by supporting Senate Bill 571. Thank you.
Thank you. Tom?
Chair Dingfelder, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf, Chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. Invasive aquatic species such as zebra mussels, quagga mussels, and others are of great concern to Trout Unlimited. We worked very hard in 2009 to pass many of the bills that helped do things such as create the boat check stations and other things. So we think it's that the Marine Board should have a permanent spot on that. It's because of the work they're doing specifically on aquatic invasive species. So Trout Unlimited supports SB 571, and we urge you to approve it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll see if there's any questions for any of the gentlemen up here. Questions?
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Hilburn, how many members are on the board now? Or what is the board compiled of, should I say?
Sure. Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson. There are 17 members currently on the board. No, I'm sorry, there's 15 members. This bill would change it to 17. So the agencies that currently have seats on the council are the Department of Agriculture, Portland State University, Fish and Wildlife, Oregon Sea Grant, the State Department of Forestry, Department of Environmental Quality. And this bill would add the State Marine Board to that list. There's also currently 2, 4, 6, 8, 9 non-agency people on the current Invasive Species Council. There's a representative from Wallowa Resources, a teacher from the Portland area, the executive director of the Northwest Weed Partnership, a representative from the Native Plant Society, a representative from U.S. Department of Agriculture, Animal Plant Health Inspection Service. The Port of Portland has a representative. Portland, the City of Portland has a representative. The U.S. Forest Service and BLM have representatives currently on the council.
I noticed from this bill, to make it clear, that it adds the State Marine Director, but it also adds another appointed member.
Correct.
So it would pick up two from the State Marine Board?
No.
Four.
One from the Marine Board and one that would be appointed.
Yes, the way it reads is a State Marine Director or a designated representative.
And one appointed member.
Yeah, but that's an additional member.
That's not an additional member.
Not necessarily part of the Marine Board.
Oh, so we're adding another member, not necessarily from Marine Board. I get you.
For balance.
Right. I get you. Okay.
The council has always had a core of agency people, but they've been outnumbered by the non-agency people, and that was set up that way on purpose, and we want to maintain that so that if the agency people, we get out of line, the non-agency people can bring
us
back
into
line.
The agency.
It's a good check and balance.
Thank you. That clarifies it for me. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you for catching that and asking that question, Senator. Any other questions? Senator Bates?
To a certain degree, this reminds me, since this is the anniversary of the Vietnam War, of what the table is going to look like at the peace talks that went on for 2 years. What I really want to know is, do you feel you're having some success in this issue I can remember back in the Great Lakes region of the 1950s when they finished the St. Lawrence Seaway that sea lamprey came in and destroyed what was actually a commercial fishery that time of trout. And we actually fixed it here from Oregon for them to put our rainbow trout and our steelhead and our salmon into the Great Lakes and develop a new fishery that could withstand the lampreys. They never fixed the problem. The lampreys are still there. They couldn't get them out. They put weirs in, tried to block them from spawning, and nothing worked. So what kind of measurements, metrics do you have to see if you're really doing something? I drove my boat into California last year, came back, nobody checked me. I took it through California up to Brookings, came back out, and they stopped me at the California border and checked me, which I appreciate. They're very nice about it. Went through it with us and made sure we hadn't picked anything up and we were fine. But what really is happening? I mean, it seems sort of sporadic as far as checking boats coming in. Are we making any progress? Do you have any idea if you're preventing these invasive species coming in at all? And changing the board, is that going to actually give you an opportunity to do that?
Senator Dingfelder and Senator Bates, I feel we are making progress. The program still is a fairly new program. It's only 3 years old. The boat inspection program has evolved over those 3 years. The first year the program was created, the inspection stations were voluntary in nature to stop. In 2011, the legislature changed that law to make it mandatory that boats stop at Oregon inspection stations. The current revenue that's generated by the sale of aquatic invasive species permits, which is a dedicated fund, is such that we are able to operate inspection stations in Oregon for about 6 months out of the year, 5 days a week, generally Tuesday through Saturday. This coming next biennium, if budgets are approved by the Marine Board and Fish and Wildlife, we'll be able to expand that system to add an additional inspection station in the Brookings and Gold Beach area on Highway 101 and operate the Ashland inspection station on I-5 at the Port of Entry from February until October. Currently, the last year, all stations operated essentially from Memorial Day to Labor Day. So we're operating as much as we can with the limited revenue that's coming into the program, and we're expanding as we are able to.
Follow up. Just out of curiosity, the one coming up I-5, which is a major entry from the southern part of the state, is that the weigh station there?
That is Senator Dingfelder and Senator Bates. Yes, that is correct. It's at the Ashland Port of Entry with the Department of Transportation facility.
And how would someone bringing a boat in know that it was open? You should drop your boat in and have it looked at.
When the inspection stations are open, there are a series of highway signs placed on the shoulder, very similar to the orange diamond shape signs that you see when you see construction zones. We have a series of four signs spaced out the previous 2 miles before the port of entry station, indicating the station is open, boat inspection is open and required. That station did open, I think, 2 weeks ago, and it will operate until October.
That's only follow up. It's only 4 or 5 days a week. It's not 24/7.
That is correct. Starting in May, we are going to operate that station 7 days a week from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. with the additional resources that we have in the funding.
And, Senator, we've had updates from Lisa Dubercare, who is the director of the, or I don't know if that's her official title, the coordinator. Yeah, for the Invasive Species Council, we were going to ask her to come and do another update.
Thank you.
We're in the process of hearing the Oregon Department of Agriculture's budget right now in the Ways and Means Subcommittee. This afternoon, we heard the key performance measures, because that's part of the key performance measures since it's housed at ODA. But this is a work in progress. Certainly, making that transition from voluntary to mandatory is an improvement. But you know, we're working to make this program more stringent.
My point, obviously, being we got a long ways. I appreciate the work you're doing, how hard it is, the limited funds. We got a long ways to go. We got trout limited here. None of us, you know, first off, understand I'm a fisherman. All fishermen are liars, but saying that.
Oh.
Very few, very We are.
That's not bad. That's not bad.
That big.
But not all liars are fishermen. So all fishermen are liars. Okay, and I've met, you know, and you'll never meet an honest one. But we don't get off the water at 7 o'clock at night. We're out there beating the water at the last possible minute and driving home at midnight to face our angry wives. So, you know, it's
or just, husbands.
Or husbands. Yeah, I got it goes both ways. So right. I mean, you got to expand the program, and I would fully support that. I know it's a huge problem and a real threat. But I understand you do the best you can under the conditions that prevail. So I didn't mean to divert us too much, right. But...
No, but it's a good point that we need to have Lisa come back and do it. She couldn't be here today, but we'll have her come back and
thank
do
you.
A update for us. Senator?
Madam Chair, yeah. Mr. Dolphin, I know you guys have been successful. I am a member of the Oregon Bass Federation. We are extremely concerned about invasive species. Do we have any in the state yet? Has any lakes been or rivers been affected yet?
Oh, yeah.
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, currently in the state of Oregon, there are water bodies with aquatic invasive species. Eurasian water milfoil is an aquatic vegetation.
Yeah.
New Zealand mud snails are a small snail. We do not have zebra or quagga mussels within the state. And broader than that, they do not exist in the Pacific Northwest. And the Northwest states that I coordinate a lot with, Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, and Washington, are all doing boat inspection programs and actively working to prevent mussels from invading the Northwest.
Follow up. I understand they are in Lake Mead. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
And there is there's a road, that highway that comes from Reno up into our state. Do we have any protection, any checks there?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, I believe that's, correct me if I'm wrong, Highway 395, perhaps, coming up through Lakeview. And yes, we have an inspection station in Lakeview during the summer months.
Thank you.
Just for a point of clarity, those of us who fly fish for trout consider bass an invasive species.
I think we're going to have to separate you two now. Maybe we'll move Beth in between the two of you. Anything on this end? Do you want to talk about other species that you want to fish for, gentlemen?
No, I'm fine.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Is there anybody else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 571? Okay. Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 571, and we will open up, senators, we will open up a work session on Senate Bill 571, and I will take a motion.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 571 to the floor with a do pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 571 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay, the clerk will call the roll, please.
Senator Bates?
Aye.
Senator Hensel?
Aye.
Senator Haas?
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Aye. With that, the motion carries, and I will carry this bill to ensure that there's no fighting between bass and fly fishermen on the floor, and make sure that we have all species represented here. But thank you, and we will, just for the record, have Lisa come in and do an update. So with that, I close the work session on Senate Bill 571, and we're done with our official business for the day, and we will move into opening up an informational hearing on the Columbia River Oregon Solutions Project, or Task Force, otherwise known as CRUST, for those listening, wondering what the acronym is. And we have Richard Whitman and Steve Greenwood, who's going to come up and introduce the panel. Thank you, gentlemen. Do you know? Okay. Before we get started, I'm just curious, Steve, do you know if all the members received the signed PDF of the Columbia River Umatilla Agreement? Because if not, we'll make sure and send it. Do we have written copies?
Yeah.
Okay, great. That would be great to have that handed out. I have my electronic copy, but okay. Take it away, gentlemen.
All right. Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, Richard Whitman, Governor Kitzhaber's Natural Resource Advisor, here today with Steve Greenwood with Oregon Solutions, who's been the project manager on this project. And we're going to set the high-level frame for this briefing on this really important and exciting project. But the people who really did the work. Many of them are here to talk to you about the details after us. So I want to start off by talking about this important area of the state, the Umatilla-Moreau County area in north central Oregon. In terms of water, there's a long history of successes and failures in water resources development in this part of the state, and I really can't do this briefing without starting by acknowledging the very hard work that Representative Jensen and former Senator Dave Nelson have done on water issues in this part of the state over the years. Really laid a lot of the groundwork for the progress that has been made in this effort that we're going to be talking about today. There have been some very important successes in terms of water resources development in this part of the state that really helped, I think, lay the foundation for this particular project. The Umatilla Basin Project by the Umatilla Tribe, involving an exchange of Columbia River water and water in the Umatilla River, has successfully restored flows to the Umatilla River and a significant fishery to that river for the first time in many, many years. In addition, this legislature had a real role in supporting the Umatilla project, the Umatilla Aquifer Storage Project that has gotten underway and has made good progress in terms of some of the initial feasibility work for that. That's a project to take water from the Columbia River during times of high flows in the winter and store that water in the aquifer in that part of the state and then use the water for irrigated agriculture during the times of the year when it's needed. The project also is being designed to result in additional flows to the Umatilla River as well. So again, it's an example of a water resources development project that delivers benefits both on the conservation side and on the jobs economic development side. And that's exactly the sort of model that we're trying to replicate with this effort. So a year ago, Governor Kitzhaber traveled out to this part of the state and met with some key leaders in the community, irrigation leaders and other leaders in the community, to talk about how can we make additional progress on this issue, recognizing that this is one of the highest value areas for irrigated agriculture in the state of Oregon. There is a real opportunity here for additional job creation and additional economic development, as well as a real need for both restoring an aquifer that has been seriously depleted by groundwater use over time and inflows in the Umatilla River. So the governor, after having those discussions with key leaders, and in consultation with them, convened an Oregon Solutions Project, now known as CRUST, the Columbia River Umatilla Solutions Team, which has worked over the course of the last year, really under the leadership of Steve Greenwood on a day-to-day basis, but convened by Umatilla County Commissioner Dennis Doherty and myself, to find consensus on specific projects that we can all agree to work on that will deliver additional water for both job creation in that part of the state as well as conservation purposes. And I'm not going to go into the details of the projects that have been agreed to. Steve is going to and others are going to go through some of that. But generally, many of the projects involve storing water during times of the year when there are adequate flows of water, the winter, and then using that water both for conservation purposes and economic development purposes when flows are low, primarily in the summer. We didn't come out with this idea out of thin air. I also need to acknowledge the work that our neighbor to the north, the state of Washington, has been doing on this issue since 2007, when the Washington legislature created the Office of Columbia River Water and the Washington Department of Ecology. The fundamental design of that program has an important lesson for us in it. The basis for that program, the reason that it got the political support in the Washington legislature that it did, was it has three components. It has development of water for irrigated agriculture, job creation. It has development of water resources for municipal purposes. And it has development of water resources for conservation benefits also. And that three-legged stool brought that wide range of interest together to support that program and has been important in maintaining the political support for that program over the long term. And that is very much what we are trying to do here on the Oregon side of the river as well, is find those consensus projects that deliver benefits in terms of job creation and conservation that will have the long-term support that's needed to actually deliver water. These projects do not happen overnight. They take time to design and then implement. And so, you know, the easy work on getting water has been done over the last 150 years, and we're now have to work hard to get additional gains. So the governor was convinced that there are solutions out there for this part of the state that can benefit both conservation and irrigated agriculture. The three general areas of projects that there's been a consensus agreement on involve storage of winter flow, improving water management practices in that part of the state, and then exploring longer-term opportunities for cooperation with our neighbors, primarily the state of Washington, but there's also work going on potentially with even Canada and the state of Idaho. So we're trying to look at this very creatively with a long-term view to what is needed in this part of the state for both conservation and agricultural purposes, and what's the best way of doing that regardless of where it's located. It doesn't necessarily have to be located in the state of Oregon. So again, the lessons here are consensus-based efforts that are locally focused can work in providing a stable platform for these projects. It helps to focus on what's practical, what's doable in the shorter term, rather than focusing first on long-term, more difficult efforts. And then, most importantly, what really matters are relationships between people. And the real success of this Oregon Solutions team is that it has brought together a diverse range of groups and interests who have really, for the is almost unprecedented in Oregon to have this broad a group of interests that have agreed to water resources development in a particular area of the state. So we're both excited about the short-term prospects here in developing some specific projects, but also believe this is the foundation for longer-term work in the future as well. So with that, I'll close and turn it over to Mr. Greenwood.
Thank you. Welcome, Steve.
Good afternoon, Chair Dingfelder and members of the committee. I'm Steve Greenwood, for the record. I'm the Deputy Director of the National Policy Consensus Center at Portland State, and in that capacity was the Oregon Solutions Project Manager for this project, and privileged, really, to work with Richard and with Commissioner Dennis Doherty and the other members of this task force. And yes, you can blame me for the acronym CRUST. I've taken some heat on that. I can take it. Besides the governor's designation, which brings with every Oregon Solutions project a sense of heightened importance, I think, and priority, and the service of high-level conveners that really help bring people to the table and, as I like to say, help them act like grown-ups once they get there. The other, I think, distinguishing feature of the Oregon Solutions programs and projects is a signed declaration of cooperation at the end. And I believe you all have now a copy of the signed declaration and a one-page summary of the strategy outlined in that declaration, which Richard referred to. And I want to reiterate something that Richard said, which is that this Declaration of Cooperation, which was signed by all the members of this task force, including, in fact, our representative from the state of Washington, that it does represent a consensus from this group. The governor early on in the process had pledged to the group to really help support proposals that came out of it that were, in fact, a consensus. And on an issue which has had its share of contention over the years, I think that the fact that what you have in front of you is a consensus action agenda is important and speaks loudly. I want to emphasize, however, that part of the consensus is that we want to work on these things together. And we're at the early stages of some of these things. There's still a lot of feasibility work to be done. So nobody has pledged to sort of jump over the cliff here on these things if they turn out not to be feasible. But everybody has pledged to work together to take it further, to investigate the feasibility, and to try to make it both legally, politically, and economically feasible moving forward. So that's what the consensus is. And let me now just very quickly and briefly describe to you what the action plan is. And again, you do have it in front of you. The first, as Richard said, is to really develop additional water storage capacity. And there were three action items that the group agreed to move forward on. One is completion of the Umatilla Aquifer Recovery Project, which Richard referred to and talked about. A second is repair of the Wallowa Dam, which certainly is outside of the Umatilla Basin itself, but it is water which flows obviously through the Wallowa Basin into the Minum and Grand Ronde River basins and ultimately into the Snake and to the Columbia. So that's a project that really has potential benefits both for the ecology of the fish in those streams, for the fish in those streams, as well as for consumptive use later downstream. The third of the options there that was recommended is the Juniper Canyon storage potential. And that's a potential above-ground storage site in Umatilla County, which I guess I would say at this point, we looked at probably six or seven different above-ground potential storage sites. That is the number one site which people felt like had the most potential, again, both technically, politically, and economically. The second area of the strategy, as Richard said, is improving water management, improving the management of the water and the water rights that we have now to put it to the best and highest use. One of the elements there is to lease unused Washington water rights. These are developed rights which the state of Washington holds in its Trust Water Rights Program. We've had a number of conversations with the state of Washington. I will tell you, frankly, I was a little dubious about the political feasibility on the Washington side of this option. We've had extremely cooperative discussions with the state of Washington and their policy advisory group, and they are on board with this option and want to explore it. These are relatively small numbers, 1,500 acre feet to 5,800 acre feet. I suppose if we were talking about 500,000 acre feet, that might be a little different for them. But they've been very, very supportive and really want to have been very helpful in proceeding. And we hope to actually get that started as early as this year. The transaction and water bank pilot, that's really a mechanism for expediting the shift or the transaction of water, again, to its highest and best use, both
economically and environmentally. And I think J.R. Cook will talk to you a little bit more about that. There's been already a lot of work done to try to move that forward for this year. And the third one is investments in conservation. And I will state here that the Umatilla Basin is known throughout the state and actually the Northwest for being a leader in conservation practices in the farming community. So this is not necessarily just in the Umatilla Basin. In fact, the emphasis has been on the Wallowa Basin, where we've had discussions with them, and they're interested in pursuing that option. So that was the options, consensus options under improving water management. And the last one is, as Richard said, developing a more regional and interstate approach to management and utilization of Columbia River water. I already talked about the cooperation we've received from the state of Washington. There are a number of actions here as well, one of which is exploring agreements with the state of Washington. If, for example, we do the repair of the Wallowa Dam, that water has to flow through the state of Washington before it gets to a point where the Umatilla Basin can utilize it. And we'd like to make sure that if we put that investment in, that in fact that water is still there and not used by state of Washington irrigators. They are, I think, very, very open to the discussion of this. They understand the issue, and it's really a matter of sitting down and working that out. The biggie here under this category, in many ways, is exploring potential joint investment in large above-ground storage. The state of Washington has already invested millions of dollars in doing feasibility analysis, what they call appraisal studies of several potential above-ground sites. They have identified a couple of those sites that they think deserve further consideration. And they have, again, expressed a desire to work with the state of Oregon in a potential joint investment. Why would they want to do that? The first thing that they would have to do is get approval for a much more expensive full feasibility analysis and authorization from Congress for such an above-ground storage site. And let me emphasize here also that this is a storage site that these are storage sites that would have water pumped to them rather than damming up a river or stream. So you're not having to worry about the salmon impacts of the above ground storage itself. Anyway, they are interested in working with us because in order to get that authorization from Congress, they think that they have a much better chance of getting something if they go in a partnership with Oregon and maybe other states as well, rather than doing it by themselves. The last piece of this is, I think, for many on the Solutions Task Force, one of the most important things to come out of this, and that is the continued capacity and staffing to have the discussions with the various states and explore the potential agreements and frankly, just do the groundwork in making these interstate agreements happen. And so those are the actions that that are under that category of developing regional interstate approaches. That's really what constitutes the consensus agenda. Those nine actions or options came out of a pretty extensive review of, I think, over 30 different other options. These are the things that the group could all agree on and all sign on to that they want to move forward on. And with that, I think I'll end, and there are other members here of the task force who are happy to give you their perspectives on it.
So why don't we see if there's a couple of questions, and thank you very much, and thank you, Steve, for you doing yeoman's work on this, and talked about this for many months, and appreciate you coming here to do the presentation. I'm going to start off with a question. I'm assuming there's going to be some more. We had on Monday Janet Newman, the former Lewis and Clark water law policy professor and expert, come and did an amazing Water 101 that really was very helpful for laying the foundation for this committee. And one of the questions that came up was, why is it, and this has been asked almost every year that I've been in the legislature, why is it that Washington has X amount of water rights allocated, and Washington has more than Oregon, and Idaho has some? And she explained to us, you know, because we don't have an interstate compact like others, like the Colorado does, although I just learned that the Missouri also does not have an interstate compact, which I was surprised about that. That was sort of negotiated early on. So I see here, I think, where you talk about other opportunities related to Canadian water and the Columbia River Treaty. We're going to hear about the Columbia River Treaty later this evening. But can either of you comment on discussions or, you know, we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know how those discussions are going to go. But is there any talk about, as the negotiations for that treaty is going on, was that discussed in the CREST, or if you, as representative of the governor's office, want to discuss that? Mr. Rittrum.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. So I think there are two questions there, and let me take them in order. The first question was a question we hear repeatedly with regard to Columbia River water. Why is it that there's been more development of irrigated agriculture on the Washington side of the river than on the Oregon side of the river? And people will bring you the aerial photographs with the irrigation circles to show you. And the reason for that is basically when the National Marine Fisheries Service first listed Columbia River salmon as threatened or endangered, they establish flow targets for flows on the Columbia River. Those flow targets are routinely not met during the summer months, and the result of that has been, in effect, a shutdown of any new water rights for direct flow from the Columbia River during the summer months. And that's true in Washington as well as in Oregon. The difference is, in both states, there were pre-existing water rights, pre-existing the listing of salmon on the Columbia River, that have continued to be developed. And so that some of that development has occurred in Washington. Some of it has also occurred in Oregon. So the development that you see in this part of both states involves really completing the development of partially developed water rights that were granted much earlier. So that's the answer to the first question. We're doing it just like Idaho and Washington are doing it. With regard to the Columbia River Treaty, both the state of Washington, well, let me back up. We will have our presentation on this tonight, but the Columbia River Treaty, most provisions of that treaty will expire in 2024. So the region, led by Bonneville Power and the Corps of Engineers, is developing a recommendation for the U.S. State Department for renegotiation of the treaty between the U.S. and Canada. So all four Northwest states, as well as the Columbia River treaty tribes, as well as a number of federal agencies, are all on what's called the Sovereign Review Team, developing that recommendation. At the request of Washington and Oregon, that exercise is including a look at opportunities for water resources development from the Columbia River system generally, looking at whether there are opportunities to store water in Canada, again during winter months, high flow months, and then use that water in the United States during times of the year when it's needed for agriculture, and frankly, during times of the year when delivering that water downstream could be helpful for fisheries also. So it's early, but the technical work that's being done looking at renegotiation is looking at some scenarios in terms of water resources development in both the state of Washington and the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, Senator Bates and then Senator Olson.
I want to follow up on the granting of water rights. I assume those, that granting occurred by the individual states to people inside the state?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates, that's correct. The water rights, the system for water rights is administered by state governments, not by the federal government.
Follow-up.
So whoever got there first back in the 1930s and 40s and 50s got more water than people came in later. First dam on the river of significance, if I remember right, was Grand Coulee, probably, built during the 30s. So how did Washington end up getting more than we did, essentially, is what I'm asking here. Did they start granting water rights much earlier? Now we're in a position of buying water rights from them, releasing water rights from them, and they're taking in more than their fair share in the first place, if you want to figure the whole thing out
and
here.
And I think Phil Ward is sitting behind you.
So Chair Dingfelder, Senator Bates, I think many of these questions can probably best be answered by Director Ward from the Water Resources Department.
So Director Ward just appeared.
Magically.
Levitated up there. Welcome, Director.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and Senator, to your question.
And
there,
For
the record, my name is Phil Ward with the Water Resources Department. Thank you, Madam Chair. Seems like after all these years of doing this, I wouldn't forget that.
I know who you are, but some of our listeners may not.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. And Senator, it's interesting because a lot of what has happened historically relative to water rights development between, say, Washington, Idaho, and Oregon is a matter of the things that Richard mentioned plus geography. So you have the entire Columbia system running through the state of Washington, north to south, down, and then Washington shares a shared border on the Columbia with the state of Oregon. And so what you saw in Washington was a bunch of federal development in the state of Washington. You mentioned Grand Coulee. That was a piece of it that occurred during those early years of agricultural development in this region. And so you saw that federal development occur there in the state of Washington much more aggressively than it did down in the Oregon side, again, largely because of the access geographically. And so you saw that development occur, and so you do have a larger development of water on the Washington side.
I'll let Senator Olson go.
I understand it. Yeah. I don't have to like it. After, I used to be a Washingtonian, so, you know, I still don't like it. There's fair and there's fair, and it sounds to me like on a basis of what their geography is and our geography is, I bet they're getting more than we are. And historically, it's probably happened that way. We probably can't reverse it.
Senator Olson?
Mr. Whitman, this is some good work, but a question for you. If this comes to fruition and we are able to allocate water into our state for use, how does it get allocated? Is it on the first water right? Do they get the most amount, or is it how will that water be allocated to the end users, or will the state be the arbiter and be selling it, or what?
Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson, we have the same system that all the Western states do. So first, it's a first-in-time, first-in-right. So it will depend on who has filed for what water rights. In terms of who gets water from water that is stored in the state of Oregon. Now, if the water is stored elsewhere, we may get into some different issues there. You may have more of a contractual issue in terms of who has first rights to the water. But I would invite, again, Director Ward to perhaps provide a little more detail.
Madam Chair, Senator, stored water is an interesting entity. And so certainly you can initially, whoever's storing the water holds the right. So if I were to build a dam and a reservoir, I would have to have a storage right to store that water. Ultimately, then I could contract for that water to parties downstream. I would deliver water to them. They would then have to have a water right to utilize that water associated with the land that they would use it on. But so again, the primary right would be the storage right, and then there would be secondary rights to actually use that water out of storage based on who had a situation where they could secure a water right for the land to utilize that water on.
Follow-up.
To really clarify this, and this is for me, because water is a difficult topic. You build a dam. Actually, we give you the money to build the dam, and we pay the money to pump the water to the storage facility. So we, the state, own the water. Do we then sell it to the primary, the first water user, the one that has the first right? Do we sell him that quantity of water, or do we give him that quantity of water?
So, Madam Chair and Senator, many states are in exactly the business you just described. So California is replete with state-owned water storage projects, mm-hmm. where the state has developed the storage project and then ultimately markets that water to the end user. That's certainly the legislature could give direction for us to give water to the end user. But in most states around the West, Oregon, frankly, is one of the few states that doesn't actually have that kind of system in existence today. California, Idaho, North Dakota, for heaven's sakes, very big in building reservoirs and marketing water. But it's a situation where the state has invested in the infrastructure and then markets the water to recover some of the cost of that development activity.
I have another one, if you don't mind.
Yeah,
follow up. Thank you. That's good to get into this. So we will be in the market to sell water. Now, once again, who gets priority? Would it be the first water holder, or is it the highest bidder?
Madam Chair, Senator, again, that could work in a number of ways. Certainly, as some of the scenarios that Mr. Greenwood talked about earlier with the Washington Water Trust water, how do you equitably make that water available so that you don't disadvantage folks, whatever? And I know some of the things that have been considered about, talked about that, in that kind of scenario is actually an auction situation where you make the water available, you see what the market is, whether there are potential buyers and what the price is, and you move it that direction. But there are many, many different scenarios that could be undertaken for something of this nature. I think the important thing is that as a state, we put in place considered checks and balances so that whatever happens, if indeed something like this comes to fruition, happens in an equitable manner.
I have one more follow-up.
Okay. Yeah.
Would this be our endeavor at the state level to build these and all that? Would this be a for-profit agency that would sell water to make a profit on the water that we've pumped in there to the farmers?
Madam Chair, Senator, I think a history of in the West would indicate that for-profit water development from a government standpoint hasn't really happened. So
all I wanted on the record. I just want to make sure that it's on the record.
I was going to suggest that if folks on this committee have not read Angle of Repose, it's a really good history on the history of water ditch companies in the West. Good old Wallace Stegner. But I'm going to just ask a quick follow-up to Senator Olson's question before I hand it over to Senator Hansel. When Professor Newman was here, I asked a question about reserved Indian treaty rights. And I know that the tribes were at the table. Can you talk about, are there any unmet federal treaty tribal water rights that would have senior, I don't know where they fall as far as as far as senior water rights or junior water rights, or if that basin's been adjudicated? Can you address that?
Madam Chair, briefly,
yeah.
There are tribal water right claims in the Umatilla Basin claimed by the Umatilla Tribe. And the state of Oregon and the federal government, people in this room today, are involved in an effort to negotiate those claims and settle them in a manner that works equitably for the entire community in the Umatilla Basin. There must have been, Bob, the fourth or fifth meeting of the settlement, the negotiation team, earlier or late last week. Tom Paul left this committee meeting on Thursday night and drove to Pendleton for a meeting of that group. Those negotiations are proceeding forward, I think, very positively. I think both the tribe and the local community representatives are very engaged in coming to an agreement that works for everyone there.
Okay, and that's independent of this process right now.
Yeah. Madam Chair, if I may, It is independent, but I will say part of the reason for having the Umatilla tribe on the team and part of the care that was taken in putting these projects together, this particular set of projects, was to move projects forward that don't conflict or interfere with any of the discussions that are going on in that process. So that has been a consideration.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hanson.
If I may, Madam Chair, thank you. Three things. First of all, the acronym CRUST. I think it was very appropriate for my longtime colleague Dennis Doherty to be
here to defend himself. That's
right. I want the record
to
show that, and there's enough people here that would carry it back, I'm sure. Secondly, I can see a little bit what my colleague was saying about selling and marketing, auctioning and stuff. I know the whole thrust and event or purpose of this is for agricultural production. If we start having to bid agriculture against industrial something else, which we might not even know here, it becomes a win or becomes a loss. So if we keep the parameters of the intent and the purpose as agriculture, then I think we keep the level playing field. And then thirdly, just as having been formerly a county commissioner this time last year, this project is just so special. History, my family was involved in the very first recharge project in the state of Oregon, funded entirely by local farmers there on the county line area between Umatilla. My brother Tyler, a longtime member of the Water Resources Department Board of Directors. My Uncle Stafford, following that, was very actively involved in the basin project, the restoration. And now, I sort of view it as maybe an opportunity for me to be involved both as a county commissioner previously, tangentially and actively involved, although Dennis had the lead, and now as a state officer. So, my personal family has had a huge involvement in trying to answer the questions that this task force has been involved in. So I'm really honored to be in a position that maybe can do some good to move this thing on forward. Thank you for your work.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Any other questions for these gentlemen? Okay. Thank you very much. And Director Ward, did you want to add anything before we have the rest of the committee members or task force members come up?
Madam Chair, just Steve asked me to make a couple very brief remarks, and certainly that they're welcome to come up as I'm doing so if you'd like me to proceed.
Why don't you go ahead and then we'll call up the rest of the folks. Yeah.
So, Madam Chair, members, it's interesting to me to look back, but it was about 30 years ago that my agency began to implement significant groundwater restrictions on groundwater use in the Umatilla Basin. That was a result of declines in the groundwater aquifer there of up to 500 feet in some irrigation wells. But the result of that is that for about 60,000 acres, we reduced what folks could use out of their groundwater resource to 12 to 15% of their water right. You can imagine that economically, that's a devastating situation for many of those farms, because the value of water added to those soils, it takes those soils, those high desert soils in that basin, from class 5 and 6 soils to class 1 and 2. And so this has obviously been a troublesome issue for many years for our agency. And I think the thing that we are so thrilled about with this recent effort is to see these consensus recommendations come forward, where folks from a very divergent viewpoints came together and brought some things forward for us to go forward with today. We're already in the process of implementation, as you've heard. Two members of my staff are in Washington right now meeting with representatives of the state of Washington and representatives of a firm in Canada that are building a new hydroelectric facility on the Canadian side of the border, and they would like to market some of that water in Washington and in Oregon. So we're talking through that. Full implementation of these opportunities that you heard Mr. Greenwood talk about earlier will take resources. I'd be remiss if I didn't note that the governor's budget does set aside about $20 million in bonding capacity, a couple different types, to help push some of this forward. So we're hopeful that we'll have some resources to move this forward in the days ahead. And if that's indeed the case, we think there's great opportunity to take a real positive step in the years ahead in the Umatilla Basin. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Director Ward. And we have three members of the CRUST. They don't look too crusty, though. So, J.R. Cook with the Umatilla Basin Water Commission, Bob Levy from the Umatilla Basin, and Kimberly Priestley from Water Watch. And these are three groups you don't necessarily always see sitting up there together, arm in arm. So welcome, and whoever wants to go first.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kimberly Priestley. I'm here representing Water Watch of Oregon. Thank you for inviting us here today to discuss briefly our perspective on this process. I'll start out by saying, you know, over the three decades that Water Watch has worked on water issues in the Umatilla Basin, we have always believed that a durable solution for the basin, for the Columbia River, its imperiled fish, and those who wish to expand irrigated agriculture in the basin requires a more thoughtful approach than repeated legislative attempts to undermine existing fishery laws. In convening the CRUST, Governor Kitzhaber provided the leadership needed for stakeholders to move beyond this annual battle and move forward on a path that would work for both farmers and fish. The forum allowed, as we heard from Richard and Steve, state and federal agencies, tribal interest, irrigation interests, and conservation interests to come to the table and take the time to look through and analyze nearly 30 options. Importantly, you know, I think it was really important that we did give this group the time because it was very important that we got to hear everyone's perspective on the various water options that were presented. You know, this interplay was really important, I think, to the final outcome, this sort of general understanding of the different interests at the table. You know, in the end, I think it was the consideration of all these values, irrigation, power, flood control, fish, and tribal considerations that led to the list of consensus options that you see before you today. From Water Watch's perspective, the CRUST agreement provides a meaningful step forward to a long-term solution in the basin. The agreement offers potential solutions that will provide additional water to Umatilla farmers without harming flows needed for imperiled fish and, importantly, without undermining existing key river protection laws. Moreover, the agreement promotes economic growth in the form of increased agriculture in a way that both recognizes and accounts for the important biological and economic value of the Columbia River fishery. I did want to say just a little bit about the economic value of fish to Oregon. I imagine that this committee will hear a lot this session about the economic importance of agriculture. And I just, you know, just wanted to state that salmon also is a major industry of this state. You know, a couple sites I have here are an Institute for Fisheries Resources report found that salmon declines have cost the region's fishing economy as much as 25,000 family wage jobs and $500 million a year for each and every year these declines are allowed to continue. A recent 2009 report that was put together by Dean Runyon Associates for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife found that healthy rivers contribute hundreds of millions of dollars annually to Oregon, most of this in rural counties. And this past year, 1,100 businesses in the Pacific Northwest signed a joint letter to the Obama administration in support of salmon restoration efforts in the Columbia. The message, a healthy salmon fishery is good for business. However, despite the substantial biological and economic value of these fish, for nearly a decade, there have been repeated attempts to legislatively allocate summer water from the Columbia River in a manner that would further jeopardize these fish. Given this history, we are especially pleased that this group could come together in a way to find water for farmers in a way that does not jeopardize flows needed for fish. The agreement provides an alternative to these annual battles. And, you know, on that note, this wasn't really touched upon by other presenters, but one of the key components of this agreement was, you know, an agreement that we would all work in good faith to promote the options in this document, and that there would be no further legislative attempts on summer water withdrawals, at least in the short term. And, you know, it may be that some wayward bills from interests not at, you know, not at the crust table make their way before this committee, but our hope is that this consensus-based agreement will provide the legislature the breathing room to move forward on development of water in the Umatilla Basin in a way that doesn't undermine flows. You know, with that, I will just say that, you know, I just want to reiterate that Water Watch sees this agreement as a win-win, both for the region and for the state, and we hope that it will signal a new path forward, one that will stand the test of time and Oregon water politics. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair, did you want to go next? I know you have some handouts, but we were hoping to have it so people in the room could see as well.
Yeah, and Madam Chair.
Unless we'd like to look at pictures.
Yeah, and trust me, I'll be brief. I just thought we'd, I like pictures as well, so I'm going to be brief and touch on a couple of high points here with the help of some visuals. But for the record, Madam Chair, members of the committee, J.R. Cook, Executive Director with the Umatilla Basin Water Commission. I guess I'm going next. I'm going to let my elder clean up over here to my right, so I'll set him up and he can clean him up. So I want to touch on a couple of high points, and I apologize if there's a little bit of humor mixed in here, but we got to keep this fun, right? So I really, 1, 5, and 6 of this slide are probably some of the most important things to me as I work not only with the crust, but also internally in the basin. And really quick, just a little bit of background here to hit on what Kimberly mentioned earlier. A little bit of background for me. I actually was put through school with the funds from commercial fish, and the late Steve Meyer, the fishing vessel Aquila, gave me the resources I needed to go to school and actually do what I do now to try to work with the irrigators and enhancing fish and also creating a better economy in Northeast Oregon. So I understand the value of that to the state, to myself personally. But number one, I think it's really important to recognize that our basin, we recognize the fact that there was an exploitation area. There was some things that we did wrong in the past, but the real value and the real the privilege for me in working in the basin is our ability to recognize them and learn from them. And I think that this process with the crust has kind of memorialized that, because we have people up there at the crust table my age that are talking about learning from the not only the mistakes, but also some of the progress our generations before us made, and making sure that doesn't get lost in what we're doing moving forward. Number five, I call it the creative child, because I have a pretty creative child at home that's always looking at all these innovations and inventions. And a lot of times, we in our basin, we throw things out there because we're trying to figure out ways not only to access water, but actually make the most environmental and economic use of the water we have for the state. And so sometimes, as we know, it's hard to promote and defend that when it's not normal. There's some new things that we're trying out that are going to kind of hit on the fringes of both the conservation community and the development community, and our ability to work through that is important. And the last, and I think the big one that you'll see me touch on, is the institutional capacity, that the crust creates a big, big long-term picture. But without the institutional capacity, both at the state level and what we're creating at the local level, we're never going to get to that. It takes time and it takes working through the issues, and that takes capacity, and that's what we really haven't had before. So next thing that the crust really let us focus on was kind of this geographic opportunity. As you see on the slide on the left, in the upper left-hand corner, there's what we call the white whale. That's where our recharge project sits. And there is a significant amount of water demand to the south of that white whale. But there's also a significant amount of demand to the east of that white whale, basically east of the city of Hermiston, moving towards Pendleton. And the recharge project really didn't get us any opportunities over there, but the CRUST, with looking at opportunities for accessing more water out of the Columbia River from upstream storage or acquisitions from Canada or out Washington, it gave us the chance to look at how can we get water into that area and how can we make the best use of it for the demand there. And I'm going to focus really quick for you on the area east of Hermiston and Stanfield and just show you what type of plumbing, so to speak, is in the basin and how we can use just a couple of tools that we're looking at with the Umatilla Solutions Task Force. The first is accessing the block of water either that's made available temporarily or permanently out of the Columbia. And there's a significant number of pipelines that extend south from the Columbia River. All the red pipelines you see are more or less private, non-federal systems. The right is a large private system from quite a few farmers, and the one on the far left is the Port of Umatilla's regional system. But those red dots that you see, though, those are all wellheads, and those are all the groundwater demand at that wellhead. That's how much water could be pumped out in any given year if we had a full allocation. Those arteries from the river don't reach all the way into those areas where the demand is. And so what we're working on internally in our basin is for those senior users and those water users that are close enough to the infrastructure to access the water we can make available, working on sub-area specific basalt banks that allows the junior user to pay the proportionate cost share to access a proportionate share of the basalt water we can leave in the ground. And that's in the short term. And as we build more infrastructure, more basalt water can be left in the ground, and hopefully we can get to a gradual recovery of the basalts, which is important in our basin for quite a few reasons. And a lot of you have seen this slide before. Really, the impetus behind this was not only not access the ability to access the Columbia, but it was the declines in the basalts. We have the largest groundwater declines in the developed world in the Umatilla Basin. And the nice thing about it is Mother Nature replenishes that naturally every year. We just have to give her a little bit of relief and get some water out of the Columbia to take the pressures off. And if we can do that, which 100 feet of basalt recovery is not inconceivable in our basin, Kent Madison's ASR project has recovered in a very short amount of time. The basalt's 94 feet, roughly. So it can happen. But 13 million kilowatt hours of peak energy savings if we can recover basalt levels 100 feet. And that's a benefit not only to our irrigators, but also to municipalities and anybody that needs that water. It's a sustainable water source. And the second one is environmental benefit. Improved groundwater systems, and ultimately, we can minimize conflict in drought years. And I still have that question down there. Maybe we can get there over the course of this CRUST, but the generational benefit to me, if the fish have all the water they need every year, but there's that one year where we're going to lose a generation of fish if we take any water out of the river, what's the value if we recover our basalts of being able to go to that system as a supplemental drought source and leave water in the river? So that's a question I think we'll be able to answer with data over time, but it's definitely one that's interested me for quite a while in this process. Another thing that's come up is, you know, the fact that we're just providing this water and creating economic benefit via agriculture. And, the green dots don't lie. Those are not direct ag-related jobs. Those are the machinists, the pump companies, the trucking outfits. And there's 144 of them just in Hermiston on that map, and it's not finished. But so we'll take any jobs we can import. But this is the other thing that people are getting out of this investment with the Umatilla Solutions Task Force is, you know, and obviously the food, the raw and process, but the biofuels industry in our basin is going strong, will continue to do so. But there's also a lot of technology, entrepreneurship, and innovation that other regions of the state and then the Pacific Northwest and ultimately the United States are benefiting from us. 3R valve, Kent Madison, ASR, a lot of presentations and a lot of education on that. The other one, regenerative drive, we have a couple of members of Pendleton City Council in here today, so I better hit on Pendleton for a second. But Pendleton's testing a regenerative drive technology with their ASR project in the city of Pendleton. They're actually capturing energy from injecting water into the basalts, and it's very, very productive for them. And actually, as a technology, we can promote to the rest of the region. And then water banking efficiency, we talked about that. The first allocation of conserved water right was issued in our basin quite some time ago. And then ultimately, the water quality innovation. We're actually testing ways that we can fix our water quality problems as well through this process. I was asked to touch really quick about the recharge project. It hasn't been lost in this process, and we're entering into a testing phase with that. Our commission's in the process of reorganizing into an operational body, and over the course of the next 5 years, we're going to try to get access to the depot, which we have not in the past. But incorporating these findings and this project into the CRUST recommendations over time will happen. But it definitely is in a test phase and will be for a few years. So lastly, Commissioner Hansel's a big Senator Hansel is a big sports fan, and the University of Oregon and Oregon State baseball teams are doing well, and I love baseball, so I thought I'd throw one analogy out when I end. It kind of referenced the big game for our project and our CRUST effort here. And I look at, you know, the boring, especially if you're a Mariners fan, the boring regular season that is baseball, you know. And I feel like the last 40 years, you know, they haven't really been boring, but they've been long. There's been some winning streaks, some slumps. And fans came and went of this project and our base. And then I think you look at the lightning round that really has been the playoffs over the last 7 years. And, you know, there's been a lot of excitement, some controversy. And, you know, depending on which side of the aisle you've been on any given year, there's been some bad calls in your opinion. But it's resulted in where we're at today. And I really believe that we're kind of at the big game with the recommendations. But, again, we're at that point where we're at the World Series, but it's a seven-game World Series process. Don't break the champagne out until game seven's in the bag. You know, we've got a long ways to go, and that big picture effort really does require the capacity, and we're willing to commit to that on the basin's behalf and willing to work with the state on developing that capacity at the statewide level. So I appreciate the time.
Great. Thank you, JR. And why don't we have Bob Levy go, and then we'll see if there's any questions. And, Bob, you have a presentation as well. Do you have that up on?
I think I have one slide. First, Chair Dingfelder, thank you very much for having me here today, and thank you for, and members of the committee, and thank you for at least making plans to visit us in the eastern part of the state, the middle of April. We welcome the opportunity to show you what's going on there. Certainly,
and I just want to mention, I came out when the ASR project first started, so I'm looking forward to hearing about the progress.
Good.
Yeah.
Okay. So certainly the CRUST process has been a wonderful experience for those of us in Eastern Oregon who have spent many years in court and down here in the legislature trying to get things done with, and we've been very unsuccessful. So this has been a success, we feel, a very successful forward step in fulfilling our goal of economic development and the dual purpose, along with economic development, of helping restore fish runs. And I think it's appropriate to recognize that since 1986 and the implementation of the Umatilla Basin Act, which was a joint effort by the Confederated Tribes and actually ODF&W and the Umatilla Irrigators, that salmon have now been returned to the Umatilla River. And I think it's important that we recognize that. Probably also important to just mention that, you know, the problem in the Umatilla Basin was not only caused by over-irrigation and over-appropriation caused by state issues, but the federal government was also actively involved in the construction of irrigation projects, at least four in that basin that also led to that problem. So let's don't, I think we should just keep that in mind. With the CRUST process, there was a number of alternatives that were mentioned by Steve. I would like to say that that work opened the doors for planning and implementation of projects now and in the future. There's a big difference between planning and implementation. So we've done some planning and now the implementation phase. I'd like to talk just for a minute about the difficulty that we're going to have with the implementation part of the water development and how the state needs to continue to give us some help legislatively and probably with some change in rules so we can implement what we need to. So the map that you see on the wall is one that you've seen numerous times or up on the screen. It's actually an aerial photo of everything from the big piece of bare land that's on the left is the Navy training ridge just south of Boardman, The one big farm that's not on this map is Three Mile Canyon Farms, which would be off to the left. So this spans the area from just west of Boardman to east of McNary Dam and east of the last irrigation project towards Wallula. The yellow dots, as you can see from the key, are the pump stations along the Columbia River. These are not all the pump stations along the Columbia River, but they are kind of the ones that we have looked at as possibilities for future development for water that might come from the CRUST program. The legend also identifies the canal systems in blue that were developed mostly by the Bureau of Reclamation. There are a couple on there that are private, but most of them are the Bureau of Reclamation. You can see the large tree farm that's all kind of squares in the left-hand side of the map and in the lower half. I'd like to tell you to put this in your file and keep it, because you don't see this map very often with the diversions listed on them, with the total capacity in gallons per minute and in CFS, which is at the bottom left corner. So when we think about developing the water that the CRUST comes up with, we have to get through all of the existing irrigation systems and get further to the south to what's commonly been referred to as the 900 or the 1,000 foot line or elevation line. And what JR was talking about, that the area he was talking about, was on the bottom right of the map. So when we try to get through those other irrigation systems, it doesn't work too well, because the pipes start out big at the river and then they get smaller as they get further away from the Columbia River. So what we have to do is we have to take pipelines back into the primary systems of other people's farms. We have to try to make arrangements with those people to hook onto their pipelines to take water to the critical groundwater areas to the south. This not only involves cooperation with landowners, but it involves new easements and new financing arrangements, which are sometimes difficult to get or to make arrangements for too. The planning that has to go on here is going to be extensive, and we're anxious to get started on it, but it will be difficult. The first question that comes to mind is, well, why not build a new pump station on the Columbia River? The problem is that just to get access to the Columbia River and to build any kind of even a small pump station costs $2 or $3 million, and in order to do that, you have to have a lot of acres to spread it over. So some of those options will not be open to us unless there is a large block of water that was to be made available sometime in the future. And so I think it's really important that I'd like to say in closing that there's one really important thing that came out of all the CRUST meetings that I feel is the most significant thing for the state of Oregon, and that's the potential opening of an Office of Columbia River, or some such acronym similar to what the state of Washington has. I believe that will allow us to participate at least in the bi-state issues, and certainly with the issues that are going on with Canada on the treaty. We're anxious to see the legislature develop that proposal, and certainly under the guidance from Richard and from the administration. Also, we do have a new local organization that JR didn't mention, but it's the Northeast Oregon Water Association. In order to implement a lot of the CRUST recommendations, it will be important for local people to find local solutions amongst landowners. It will be a very difficult process, and we're going to need the help of an area-wide organization to do that. So knowing that we're short on time, I'll end my presentation there.
Thank you, Mr. Levy. Thank you very much. We'll see if there's any questions and get the lights back up. Any questions? Okay, I have one, because I'm not going to let you guys off that easy. But I have a question about the blue lines in there, the canal system. And that, is that run by one irrigation district, or is it multiple?
There's four major irrigation districts in the area. There's the Stanfield, Westland, West Extension,
and Hermiston.
Okay. I should know that because I know all those names. And then the question, and maybe this, you can probably answer this, but it could also be for Steve. As part of the conservation methods, did you look at either lining or piping those canals to see and how much savings was found in? I'm assuming you're going to lose some of it. They're open. Are these all open canals?
None. Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, we have looked at more or less a dual system where during the summertime, is there the ability to run more pressurized pipe? Because there's a mixture of lined portions of these canals and unlined. But what we have experienced in our basin, which is very unique again, our basin's always unique, is West Extension, the most downstream irrigation district, which runs 3 mile dam and extends, that's that canal, that blue line that's running east to west. They're reliant upon return flows back to the Umatilla River that they then originally diverted, which now they exchange via the Phase 1 exchange agreement. So any lining of some of the federal systems requires some significant collaboration and cooperation for them, because they actually experience impacts to the Umatilla system by us lining the canals. And so there has been a lot of and the Finger Lines and others, Westland's done a lot of pressurized work and piping, but there is a lot of concern about any more canal efficiency just because of the return flow impact for fish and the downstream irrigators.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
I recall either in February session or in 2011 that we actually had a bill before us that allowed a reverse transfer of water from one pump station. They were able to go from the Columbia River to a pump station, and they couldn't. The other one could go from the Umatilla River to the pump station, and they were connected. Is that what we're talking about?
They are.
Yeah, Chair Dingfelder, Senator Olson. Yeah, that bill passed. That was actually, it allowed us to exchange a permit. Originally, it had to be the exchange of a certificate, and that's exactly right. For recharge, it would allow us to do some creative exchanges where we could blanket an area with the Columbia River permit, and then through some creative work with some of the districts, exchange their Umatilla River water in areas to do recharge and move water around more efficiently. One of the things, again, that limits our ability to really test that in a larger scale right now is just some of the ongoing negotiations with the tribes due to the Umatilla River water and their claim on that. But that is a tool in the future. We love tools, and that is one of them that we might be using.
Great.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you all for coming here, especially Bob and JR, because I know you came a long way, and we really appreciate it and all the hard work. And I know there's many other stakeholders that were involved and at the table, and hopefully they're listening. We were there with the governor at the signing just a few weeks ago, Senator Hansel and I, and really appreciate the hard work that's been done. And obviously we've got some more work to do as we try to see how we can best move forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with that, we are adjourned.